This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Donald Trump has officially been in office for 1 year, and now the big question is, will Oprah Winfrey take his spot? She gave a rousing speech at the Golden Globes, but did it signal her entry into the presidential race? Here's what Saturday Night Live had to say about the matter.
Let's go live by satellite to a special guest.
I'm here!
Oprah, I thought I smelled lavender and money.
Oprah, are you running?
Well, I am a celebrity, so I'm qualified. But I'm different from Donald Trump because I'm actually a billionaire. So who knows? I mean, there's only one job in the world more powerful than being president.
Oh, really? What's that?
Being Oprah!
As Leslie Jones as Oprah Winfrey recently on Saturday Night Live, Oprah's Golden Globe speech also touched the Me Too movement and the story of a lesser-known civil rights activist, Recy Taylor. Well, these are some of the topics we're going to talk about today on Back Channel, our series Connecting Culture and Context. Later, we'll also talk about two different artistic portrayals of Chicago's South Side and preview this year's Grammy Awards. Joining me now, as always, popular culture experts Natalie Bullock-Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie's a professor of film and broadcast media at St. Augustine's University in Raleigh. Welcome back, Natalie.
Thank you, Frank.
Also with us, Mark Anthony Neal, chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke, an author and the host of the webcast Left of Black. Welcome back, Mark.
How are you doing, Frank?
Let's hear some more of that speech. Right now, Oprah Winfrey at the Golden Globes, first black female recipient of the Cecil B. DeMille Award.
What I know for sure is that speaking your truth is the most powerful tool we all have. And I'm especially proud and inspired by all the women who have felt strong enough and empowered enough to speak up and share their personal stories. But it's not just a story affecting the entertainment industry. It's one that transcends any culture, geography, race, religion, politics, or workplace. So I want all the girls watching here and now to know that a new day is on the horizon.
Oprah Winfrey at the 2018 Golden Globes, talking to Natalie Bullock-Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie, that speech, certainly the biggest moment of the night. What was your take on her speech overall?
Well, I mean, it's Oprah.
Yeah.
And her years of being in, being a celebrity, her experience, I mean, all the things that she's gone through, you know, just seem to inform that speech. And I mean, honestly, the first time I heard it, it brought tears to my eyes because, you know, she has a presence and she has a way of really putting her finger on, like, you know, what needs to be said and what people need to hear in the moment. So I was really impressed by her speech, but I did not take it as like this is the beginning of Oprah's campaign to be president. And quite honestly, I don't want her to run for president. I think she would be an amazing president, actually. But like, I don't want to see her go through what Hillary Clinton went through. And Oprah is black. So Oprah is going to go through even more. She's going to be skewered in ways that even Hillary wasn't skewered. And, you know, so that's that. But then even on top of that, I just feel like, you know, we don't need to keep walking down this cult of celebrity path. I think we need to get back to a place where our presidents reflect people who have experience in policy, who know how to pull people together around them, who actually know what they're doing, who don't have particular like personal axes to grind that they do through government. So I would prefer that we back off of celebrities as president and we start, you know, we go back to people who actually know how to govern.
Mark, what was your take on this? Because as you know, I don't watch awards shows, so I, of course, didn't see it. And then I looked for the buzz, went back, and I read the speech first. First thing I did was read it, and I saw nothing in there that indicated to me that she was saying I'm running for president. So I thought to myself, where is this coming from? And I wonder what you make of that, because there's nothing in that speech that says I'm running for president.
Well, two things. nothing in the speech has said that. And, you know, let's remember Oprah, among other things, is an incredible actress.
Mm-hmm.
So the speech itself
is a
performance. Where the moment where we have accepted that the leaders of our government are brands. And it's not just about Trump, because if we're being honest with ourselves, part of the appeal of Barack Obama is that he represented such a unique brand. Mm-hmm. Folks bought into him because he was a brand. The social media apparatus that emerged around him,
mm-hmm.
First time it was used to that extent in terms of presidential election, was about the branding of Barack Obama and the promise that that brand represented. And so it's not unusual, you would think, particularly younger voters and folks who are expecting certain kinds of dramatic change would be invested in the idea of someone who was a bigger brand than Trump, right? A more compelling brand than Trump. I would even go to make the argument that part of what always ticked off Trump about Obama when Obama was a president is that he was a bigger brand than mm-hmm. Trump was mm-hmm. a brand at that particular point in time. So, like, you know, just what Natalie said, I mean, it's a dangerous road to look at our politics, and particularly progressive politics, as being led by what represents a particular kind of brand. It's the same reason why we would not want Jay-Z or Beyonce to run for president, even if we thought they would do, a decent job.
Yeah, but if that's really where we are, then that's who's going to get elected. In other words, it's going to be the best brand, whether you like it or not, because the days of Adlai Stevenson for president are over.
Right.
I mean, don't we need...
And part of that is campaign reform, right? Because the biggest brands, what generates the most money. I mean, we know exactly what this looks like. Yeah.
Let's talk about some real substance that Oprah did bring, however dramatically and theatrically. She talked about a very important story, and that is the story of Reese Taylor that she brought to light again. Let's talk a little bit more about the significance of it before we actually get to this clip. Natalie, her story and the fact that it received this kind of a platform and spotlight.
Mm. Well, I have a couple of thoughts about Reese Taylor's story being brought to light in the way that it has through this documentary by director Nancy Bersky. First of all, it just feels like completely perfect synergy that Reese Taylor's story would emerge in the way that it has in the midst of the Me Too movement. And I have to hasten to add that the Me Too movement has been going on for 10 years. Tarana Burke started it 10 years ago. So we're just hearing about it. That's what's going on. But the fact that it has received so much attention at this particular time because of the Harvey Weinsteins and Charlie Roses of the world, I think it's remarkable that Reese Taylor's story surfaces in the way that it has at this moment. At the same time, I struggle with the fact that this is a Black woman's story that is being told by a white woman.
You're talking about the new documentary.
The new documentary, mm-hmm. Yes. And that, you know, just as a filmmaker, as a someone who's interested in the ways that race plays out in pop culture. And of course, we've talked about Oscars So White, which is kind of a little bit of a different point. But the fact that this story would probably not have gained the sort of attention that it's gaining if Nancy had not done it, is not lost on me. And because I'm in the documentary world, like, I know that Black people have a really hard time getting the chance to tell Black stories.
Nancy Bersky, of course, the producer and director of the documentary, The Rape of Reese Taylor. Reese Taylor, of course, the story is, I think, fairly widely known now because of the Golden Globe speech. But here she is, Reese Taylor herself, telling her story about the night that she was raped in 1944 in Alabama.
We went on to church and came back. A car run around upside of us. Six young men jumped out with a gun and said, "You the one that cut a white boy in Clopton." And the police got us out looking for you. You get in the car and we'll take you uptown to the police station. And they got me in the car and carried me straight to the wood. But before they got where they was going, they blindfolded me. After they messed up and did what they're going to do, they said, "We're going to take you back. we're going to put you out. But if you tell it, we're going to kill you. So first person I met was my daddy. And he said, what in the world are you been? And I said, some white boy took me out and messed with me. Then the next person I met was Mr. Lewis, was the high sheriff. And he asked me, he said, well, Reese, what in the world happened to you tonight? And I told him.
That's a clip of Reese Taylor talking with NPR's Michelle Martin in 2011. She passed away in December of last year, 3 days before her 98th birthday. I'm talking with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on Back Channel. Mark?
So there are a couple things. I first heard about Reese Taylor and Danielle McGuire's book, Dark End of the Street, which is titled after the James Carr song. Danielle's book came out 2010. I'm always proud to talk about the fact that we had her on Left the Black during the first season talking about it. And, of course, we talk about Nancy Bersky, which gives us a kind of dorm connection, as does the producer Beth Hubbard, who's literally a Duke in terms of her family lineage. I think there's a moment, to Natalie's point, where we can potentially talk about what restorative justice might look like, even in the context of the documentary fields. So sometimes things get done that represent stories that need to be told that we can't tell. But part of the restorative justice process means that there are other folks who have the mechanisms and the wherewithal to be able to tell those stories.
Let's take a break right here. Natalie Bullock Brown, Mark Anthony Neal, the latest episode of Back Channel on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We will continue our conversation after this. Stay tuned.
And this bitter earth, so bitter after all.
This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow talking with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal as they join us for another installment of Back Channel, connecting context and culture. And Mark, before the break, we were talking about the story of Reese Taylor, the documentary recently done by Nancy Bersky, who of course was here in Durham, and she was once sort of executive director of the
Full Frame
and all of that. So we know Nancy from this area. The documentary itself has gotten some attention, but you're talking about the story as well as the documentary.
You know, because it's a wider story, and I think there's always these situations, and we see it many times, in which Black scholars and thinkers and filmmakers don't get access to materials in ways. It's the privileges of whiteness that allow them to tell the story. What you always hope in that context is that they were sensitive enough to also utilize the expertise of folks who do the work in order to tell these stories. And I think that's one of the things that they largely achieve with the rape of Reese Taylor, in part because she's such a prominent fixture in the film itself, right? Her voice is a centerpiece of what's happening there. And it allows us to tell these stories that don't get told, right? Whether we're talking Reese Taylor or we're talking Claudette Colvin, you know, in 1955, you know, so much of the Reese Taylor story is about, yes, what happened to Reese Taylor and so many Black women then and after, but also how we had this innocuous view of who Rosa Parks was as, you know, the seamstress who just decided one day to be political. And when you realize that this is her cutting her teeth in her social justice work 11 years before
social justice work as the rape investigator.
In other words, that's how bad it was in
Alabama for a Black woman to be.
Exactly. I mean, that story in itself is amazing because it also challenges our perceptions of who we think these social justice warriors actually were.
That's right. And, you know, let me just say that I by no means mean to take anything away from what Nancy has done, because I know Nancy, and Nancy, I know, has been working hard to bring a variety of stories to light. So it's really a larger issue that I have that is just in, you know, who gets to tell these stories? In the case of Reese Taylor, and, you know, just what you brought up, Frank, about the fact that both of you, Mark and Frank, were talking about, you know, the fact that there were so many rapes going on at this time that a whole bureau had to be established in order to address these. You know, Black bodies are still being, you know, are still under assault. And the fact that we aren't that much further along in terms of the resistance for Black people to tell their own stories is really what I bristle at. I think the type of investment in the larger culture in, you know, allowing Black artists, and I'm talking about allowing in terms of funding, giving those artists who are interested in telling similar stories, and there are many stories to tell, right? Just not giving them that space, not feeling like, you know, we have the ability to tell these stories when there are stories. So, yeah.
Is this the start of a change? I mean, are we seeing now perhaps because of this? I mean, I think about how much we knew about some of the very famous cases when Emmett Till was a case and a story that was so pivotal in the civil rights movement. And now we're going back over this territory and saying, you know, at the same time, did you know what else was going on? Does bringing those stories forward now, particularly in the Me Too, in this context of Me Too, suggest that maybe we're making amends and moving forward?
I think for a few reasons. One, because we now have a generation of journalists, many of them Black women, also historians, scholars, many of them Black women, who are interested in doing work around gender and sexuality and sexual violence. And so their ability to go back into much more accessible archives than they were 20 years ago to tell these stories, to have multiple platforms in which to tell these stories, I think changes the way that we think about that archive.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about another story, a woman who was telling a story, the story of her father and by extension her own, and came to public attention with the death of her father, Erica Garner, who Eric Garner, of course, died at the hands of New York City police in 2014. Erica died in December at the age of 27, suffered brain damage after a heart attack. And here she is back in 2016.
My dad's name is Eric Garner. No one gets to see their parents' last moments, and I was able to see my dad die on national TV. They don't know what they took from us. He wasn't just someone that no one cared for him or no one loved him. He was loved dearly. I'm just trying to get the truth out there to tell his side of the story. He was being the loving, caring man that he was, and he was murdered. For a whole year, I've protested and every Tuesday and Thursday. I feel like a representative for people throughout this whole nation because I'm doing this, I'm speaking out, me being his daughter. And that's what I wanna do, I just wanna tell my truth. I'm never giving up, I'm never gonna forget, and I don't want the world to forget what happened to my dad.
That's a clip of Erica Garner from 2016 speaking about her father in a campaign endorsement video for Bernie Sanders. Natalie, Erica Garner was initially apprehensive about becoming the face of this movement, eventually became an outspoken activist, and as I said, died in December. What do you think about her legacy? Tell us more.
Well, I mean, you know, the thing that stands out to me about Erica Garner is that, you know, as you said, from what I've read, she was reluctant to, you know, become the face of a campaign, basically, to bring justice to her father. You know, but I think what inspires me about Erica Garner is that in spite of that reluctance, she did it. And she made a difference, and she became a national spokesperson for her father. She became his voice in the absence of that voice. And I think what that says is that all of us have within us the ability to move social justice, to act on behalf of social justice, to move it forward in our own ways. And I think a lot of people would say, I'm reluctant to get involved. I'm reluctant to march. I'm reluctant to rally. But she showed that, and, you know, sometimes you just have to go ahead and do it. Even, you know, I tell my kids all the time, you're not always going to want to do the things that you have to do. But especially in this era where there is so much that is wrong in our culture and in our society, we have to do it in spite of our reluctance. So that's what she represents to me.
Mark?
Erica Garner carried the trauma of her father's death on and in her body until it killed her. And part of what she was carrying was trying to make sure that his death wasn't simply another spectacle in this ongoing spectacle of the violence of race, anti-black violence, if you will. What I find was remarkable in that moment after her death were the folks who were close to her and around her and who were trying to protect her legacy and her father's legacy, their unwillingness to allow her death to become a spectacle.
Right.
Hence the demands that when stories were written, that they would be written by black journalists or journalists of color who had some sort of sensitivity to her father's story and the trauma that she carried in trying to tell her story, which is not just the trauma of her father's death, but what it means to be a black woman, right, regardless of who Eric Garner was, right? Erica Garner is carrying all kinds of trauma that has everything to do with the reality of being a black woman in society. And so that was, I think, a telling moment of how the community cared for and about her, you know, both before her death and obviously after her death.
I want to turn now to the new PBS documentary, Lorraine Hansberry, Sighted Eyes, Feeling Heart, which tells the story of the young playwright behind the award-winning play A Raisin in the Sun. And I want to start with a clip from that documentary.
The most ordinary human being has within him profound anguish. You don't have to go to the kings and queens of the earth. Every human being is an enormous conflict about something, even if it's how you get to work in the morning. I thought that it would be very interesting to explore the most ordinary man, say, on the south side of Chicago.
That's a clip of Lorraine Hansberry talking about writing the play Raisin in the Sun. That is archival audio of her. It's featured in the new PBS documentary, Lorraine Hansberry, Sighted Eyes, Feeling Heart. And I'm talking to Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on Back Channel. Mark, Lorraine Hansberry, first ever black woman to author a play performed on Broadway. She wrote A Raisin in the Sun when she was just 29 years old. And the documentary sort of tells the story of how she came to do that and a bit of her backstory.
An amazing, impactful figure from the mid-20th century. The play itself, you know, a black woman playwright, a young Lloyd Richards as a black director, a young Sidney Poitier as a star. There, as the documentary talks about, there were 10 prime jobs for African-American actors in this play that had never existed on Broadway before. You know, I grew up in a generation where we were raised on Nina Simone's song To Be Young, Gifted, and Black. It was some years later before I realized the inspiration for that was, in fact, Lorraine Hansberry in her own words and about the friendship between Nina Simone and Lorraine Hansberry that was ongoing and who Simone lifted up in her death in terms of her memory. The documentary is so important at this period of time because Lorraine Hansberry is one of these folks that gets forgotten in the larger narrative. One, because we don't think about drama and stage the way we did 50 years ago when there was no cable television and there was no internet and black playwrights were significant contributors to our sense of what the black experience is. And so she is a throwback in that regard, but that story, right, quintessential story about the come up, trying to get from the working class to the middle class and retain your dignity, you know, in the context of the play as a black man, but more broadly as black people, it is one of the most compelling stories ever told by an African-American thinker.
And her decision to write about ordinary people, not the extraordinary elements of black experience that perhaps a white audience might recognize from afar, but one that a white audience would have no, absolutely no recognition of. It's not legible to white audiences, which was clear in its reception.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, I also, one of the productions that or plays that Lorraine Hansberry writes is one that is populated with all white actors and where she's pushing the envelope on, you know, all of these issues, sexuality and race and class and all these things. And you know, that were, I guess, in the context of the early 60s, there's a black woman playwright writing a play with white characters and talking about all these things that she's not supposed to be talking about. You know, she was really ahead of her time in terms of the vision that she had for what was possible. And I can't help but wonder if, you know, just dealing with having to negotiate this world where she is young, gifted, and Black, and that is not valued. It's not recognized. But on top of that, she's, you know, she's queer, but in a heterosexual marriage, and all these things that she's grappling with. I wonder if that also, in its own way, didn't, you know, become toxic in her body to the point where she dies of cancer, right? At 34. So, you know, I guess the burden of just being so brilliant, and having all of these ideas about what's possible and trying to pursue them, and at the same time not, you know, being stymied at, you know, in all kinds of different ways, had to be difficult.
And the criticisms that she had to endure. I mean, this is a highly successful play, clearly. It does extremely well. It's groundbreaking in the fact that she becomes the first woman playwright, Black woman playwright, to get a play staged on Broadway. But then the critique and the way it was received. Let's listen to this. This is Lorraine Hansberry, who won a top prize from the New York Drama Critics. Here she is being interviewed about the award.
First, let me ask you this. John Chapman, the drama critic for the New York Daily News, wrote that perhaps part of the acclaim may be a sentimental reaction. An admirable gesture, I think, is the way that he put it, to the fact that you are a Negro, and one of the few Negroes ever to have written a good Broadway play.
I would imagine that if I were given the award because they wanted to give it to a Negro, it would be the first time in the history of this country that anyone had ever been given anything for being a Negro. I don't think it's a very complimentary assessment of an honest piece of work.
That's a clip from the new documentary, Lorraine Hansberry, Sighted Eyes, Feeling Heart. I'm talking with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Good answer, Mark.
I tell you, Black woman shade knows no bounds, whether it's in 1959 or 2018. That's like the most brilliant response you could ever imagine.
Right.
Let's move on. I want to talk about this. Speaking of Chicago, let's bring it right up to date. The Chi, a new Showtime drama created by Lena Waithe and its executive producer, produced by Common. Let's listen to Lena now talking about the series.
Men are really at the forefront. Women are always the backbone, and every male character has one or two or three strong female characters in their lives. But I really felt like Black men specifically were being targeted. They had a really big target on their back. They were being dehumanized in such a way that I thought was dangerous, because I felt like the more they dehumanize us, the more people become desensitized to our deaths. And I thought that was so problematic. And so what I was hoping to do was to really put some humanity behind the headlines and some humor as well, and make it so that people would be so attached to these fictitious characters that when real Black bodies drop, they would care.
Lena Waithe, the creator of the new Showtime drama, The Chi, talking with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on Back Channel. Tell us more about The Chi. Natalie, you're the Chicago person on our show.
Yes, I'm the Chicago native. Well, I watched the premiere actually online, and I was blown away. I think it's well written. I think it's amazingly acted. There are characters that you recognize from other films and HBO and Showtime pieces. You know, but what I really, really appreciate about The Chi and what Lena Waithe is doing is exactly what she describes. I think she, at least in the premiere, you really get to know some of these male characters. And, you know, and so it matters, like it hurts when a couple of them are killed. And you care, you begin to become involved in their interior lives in ways that I don't think, you know, other than maybe Queen Sugar, that we really get to get inside of who these these men and women are, but mainly the male characters. We really get to understand something about their intricacies and their nuances, and I think it's really refreshing, even as we continue to see like the depiction of death and shootings and, you know, all of this black on black violence that Chicago's become so famous for, but it's really contextualized in a way that I think is helpful.
Mark?
I think it's so important, you know, at a moment, and Me Too speaks to this, that we don't ignore the black male experience. What we need to do is do better, paying attention to all of our experiences within our community. And ultimately, what you want out of all of these stories is just truthful storytelling. That reflects who these people are and what they're grappling with and what the humanity is. And she's achieved that to a great extent in ways that, you know, from the early stages we haven't seen in a while, right? It's not The Wire, right? It's not an HBO production.
Right.
It feels like it's a little bit more attentive.
Absolutely.
Right, to who these folks are in Chicago.
Natalie Bullock Brown, professor of film and broadcast media at St. Augustine's, Mark Anthony Neal, chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke. We are talking today on the latest installment of Back Channel, Connecting Culture and Context, and our conversation will continue in a moment. Please stay tuned.
So we might as well give it all we got.
This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. It's Back Channel, our program connecting culture and context. And we turn now to music. The 2018 Grammy Awards this Sunday, and it's an especially big year for hip-hop artists. North Carolina artists Rhapsody and Ninth Wonder are in the running for awards. Jay-Z leads the pack with 8 nominations in total. Jay-Z also just dropped a new narrative music video for his song Family Feud from his new album. It is directed by Ava DuVernay. And still with me are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. So let's start with a clip from Jay-Z's new music video, Family Feud.
My beloved ancestor was one of the chief architects of the confessional papers and one of America's founding mothers. She and a group of women from all walks of life revised the Constitution over 444 years ago. At a time, mind you, when some thought that making America great meant making us afraid of each other.
Now, ladies, it's time to discuss the Second Amendment.
If you make it illegal, you'll drive it underground.
Not want to protect themselves, not want to protect their families.
If you have to understand the hurt you've inflicted, already you're winning something.
Some people should have the right to bear arms.
You have distance from the person you're killing.
I understand your point. In a perfect world, it would be lovely if we could all just put down our weapons and get along, but that's not the world that we live in.
Ladies, this is just like the 13th Amendment. Some people have their liberties and some people don't. America is a family, and the whole family should be free. It's like I remember my father saying when I was a little girl, nobody wins when the family feuds.
That's a clip from the music video for Jay-Z's song Family Feud, directed by Ava DuVernay. My guests are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on Back Channel. Tell us more about this video, Mark.
It is the last video that was released from this album. It's a signature piece that's not so much about the marriage, if you will, but the decision to try to hold it together for whatever legacy that represents. You know, we've looked at black artists, and I'm thinking mainly about visual artists, for a long time who've had to both be artists and also be commercial artists in order to survive. Jay-Z's in this interesting moment where he's been a commercial artist his whole career. You could say the same thing about Beyonce, but now after Lemonade and Beyonce's work, he's now making this shift to being an artist. and recognizes his own limits. So why don't I get some of the most brilliant artists and thinkers and actors and bring them into the room? This is my idea. You'll go into the field and play for it, right? And if you're Ava DuVernay and some of these artists, you love this because suddenly you have access to resources to be able to tell stories the way that you want to tell on Jay-Z's dime. When all is said and done, what we see is a very nice contribution to what we think of more broadly as hip-hop, and one that speaks to the idea of women-centered power within our particular communities and our government.
Yeah. Yeah, tell us more about that. I mean, it is a star-studded cast, and we see a group of America's founding mothers in this speculative fiction.
Yeah, speculative. Yes, yeah. And I think that that's one of the, you know, more powerful things about the Family Feud video is this vision of, you know, what would it look like? Mm-hmm. What would happen if we had a cabinet of women making decisions and you know, deliberating over the issues of the day instead of, you know, all men, which is typically what we have. And these are women of color, you know, on top of that. And the, you know, just I, the other thing is the legacy. I mean, you know, that you see we're going from, what, 2044 to 2000, 2200 and something, but right. we see this span of time during which these ancestors of Black folks are doing, you know, deep work, deep cultural work, deep historical work that resonates for years and years and years. And I think, you know, that's Ava, number one. Right. I think that's how she thinks, and she is so clearly a visionary when it comes to thinking about how to represent and depict Black people. But I think, I think we got to give Jay-Z, you know, it's not just his money that is being used, but he helped to create this story. And, you know, and I think that he is part of this vision. And I think Jay-Z, you know, not only in the video, but in the album is really showing himself to be mature and thoughtful in ways that I don't think we always expect.
It was funny. 50 Cent just issued some comments and said that, you know, Jay-Z's 444 didn't connect with the kids. Wasn't supposed to. Right. Yeah. He's in a different space now. He's not making music for 18-year-olds. He's making music for 38 and 48-year-olds.
That's right.
Yeah, but it has a meta narrative, it seems to me, which you talked about the legacy and these kinds of references to, you know, sort of putting it together and making references to founding documents that haven't been written yet. Mm-hmm. Right. So this is an epic speculative fiction that could be a 9-part right. series and novels in 7 minutes,
yeah.
right? Seven
right.
and a half minutes. But it also says founding documents matter, and everybody makes mm-hmm. reference to them. So you look at your own founding documents and right. see the poison right. in some of those documents, and yeah. then you'll understand why we are where we are in 2018. Yeah. And that's not even the point, but I think it becomes a meta-narrative.
Yeah.
Let's talk more about what we're going to see at the Grammys. Natalie, you picked Kendrick Lamar's song Loyalty that features Rihanna as the best rap song as sung performance. Tell us why.
You know, because I just love that song. And I think, as I said last month, for those of you who tuned in then, that, you know, Loyalty, I think, you know, Kendrick is talking about loyalty in the sense that, you know, are you going to ride with me? You know, kind of in the traditional sense that we think of, which is, do we have people who are around us who are going to be loyal to us? But at the same time, I think that he is speaking to this present moment. I think the song resonates in a way that it can be applied to the fact that with all this tribalism and nationalism, white nationalism and the presumed Black nationalism, that, you know, we are also very much caught up in this idea of loyalty and who we are going to ride for, who we're going to back up. And so to me, I just think it's a brilliant song. I love the fact that Rihanna is on it, and it's hot. That's all I can say.
Let's listen to a little bit.
Tell me who you're loyal to. Is it money? Is it fame? Is it weed? Is it drink? Is it coming down with the loud pipes in the rain? Big chilling only for the power in your name. Tell me who you're loyal to. Is it love for the streets when the lights get dark? Is it unconditional when the robbery don't stop? Tell me when your loyalty is coming from the heart.
Tell me who you're loyal to. Do it start with your woman or your man? Do it end with your family and friends? Or you're loyal to yourself in defense? I said, tell me who you're loyal to. Is it anybody that you would lie for? Anybody you would slide for? Anybody you would die for?
That's what
I said, I'm geek and I'm fired up. All I want tonight is just get higher.
All I want is
loyalty, loyalty, loyalty. Loyalty, loyalty, loyalty. 10-4, no switching sides. Feel something wrong. You acting shifty, you don't vibe with me no more. I need loyalty, loyalty, loyalty. Loyalty, loyalty, loyalty.
That is Kendrick Lamar featuring Rihanna on the song Loyalty from the 2017 album Damn, popular culture expert Natalie Bullock Brown picked for this year's Grammy Award. She joins me alongside with Mark Anthony Neal, and you both picked Ledisi for her R&B performance. I want to listen to a clip of Ledisi's song High.
Kind of over all the hard times I've been through, love brought me to, and I finally feel loose, my heart I choose. My heart been broke down in the dirt and I finally see blue. Raise hands, feel focused, and I'm done being broken. Talk about love, real love, you the only thing that get me up. I'm high, got me so far up that I could fly. Watch me fly, keep me high in your blue sky. It's about damn time, I just wanna be high. Ooh, you're making me high.
That's Ledisi. Hi, one of the pop culture expert Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal's picks for Grammy Award joining me today on Back Channel. Mark?
Look, I love SZA and I love all these young wobblers because I'm an R&B guy when all is said and done. Yeah. But I need a grown woman singing R&B in my ear. And, you know, Ledisi has been doing this for more than a minute. I mean, she's been grinding in ways that, you know, have gone unrecognized.
Yeah.
And there have been Grammy nominations before, but I think there's something about this particular album where it all came together in terms of our artistic vision. So it's great that it's getting the kind of recognition that it's getting. And again, I always think about R&B as being more of the everyday fabric of Black communities. Hip-hop does a certain kind of thing, gospel and jazz, but when the rank and file is always, you know, wanting to hear some good R&B. And Ledisi is the best representative of that, I think, in the industry at the moment.
Yeah, and you know, Ledisi also, as Mark said, she is so underrated. Mm-hmm. I mean, this woman can sing. She can sing because she and she can she. There's so many different arenas that she pops up in. You know, she's done collaborations with Robert Glasper, who's a jazz pianist. She's R&B singer in her own right, but she's shown up on some hip hop albums as well, and she has this love and respect, you know, that's in the industry. But as far as commercial success, it's kind of been elusive to her. So I really hope that she wins something on Sunday night because she deserves it. And she is riding hard for the dark-skinned, curvy, dreadlocked Black woman that is, you know, trying to make a commercial go of it. You know, as a commercial artist that doesn't quite get the commercial success. So I really hope that she wins.
Has she changed or have we changed? I mean, what is it that accounts for this, Mark? She's talked a little bit about her evolution and she has said that she feels that her music has matured and she has matured over time.
Well, I think because the platforms have changed in terms of how we access music, record companies don't have as much as a hand in the marketing and folks find the music. And you know, the thing about Ledisi, and this is, you know, point of what Natalie just said, the record labels perceive that there's no audience for a dark-skinned, thick, dreadlock Black woman, right?
Right.
There is, in fact, an audience. I'm one of those folks
Thank
in
you.
That audience.
Right.
Two.
And so she,
at least two.
Okay.
So it's a moment where she can better take advantage of those opportunities, right? And again, the fact that she, you know, had that moment in Selma gave her a kind of moment that, you know, a larger mainstream got a chance to see who she was and hear her sing, even if it wasn't what we think of as typically her music.
Right.
And she talked about actually being in that film and making her a better storyteller, which a good singer needs to know, to being able to tell the story and find the story in the song. Mm-hmm. So she talked about that experience as having helped her evolution. The New Jersey native SZA came out with her first major label debut album. That was last year, got a lot of acclaim. Mark, tell us about SZA and why she's your pick for Best Urban Contemporary Album.
So, you know, she's on TDE, which is Kendrick Lamar's label, so she's coming out of that family. You know, there's a quality to her singing, her voice of wanting, of lacking something, desiring a certain kind of attention. What I love about the song, besides the fact it's so finely crafted, it's the only song that I can think about that both myself and my 15-year-old daughter will sit in the car and sing together, right? So she is connecting generationally across generations in terms of her sound and her own storytelling.
Thank God you're listening to that and not NPR. I hate it when parents tell me that. Let's listen to some SZA, will you?
My man is your man, hurt is her man too. My man is your man, her, that's her man. Tuesday and Wednesday, Thursday and Friday, I just keep him satisfied through the weekend. You like 9 to 5.
That's a little bit of Weekend from SZA, her new album, Control. I'm talking with pop culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Mark, you also wanted to talk about CeCe Winans, up for Best Gospel Album.
Yeah, one of the finest gospel albums she's ever recorded. And part of it is that the production quality is so incredible. And it has this old school, lush 1960s production style, as if you were imagining Nat King Cole as a black female singer singing gospel music arranged, you know, in this kind of orchestral way. It's a fascinating recording, kind of went under the radar because it's not the kind of recording that black gospel radio would have played. And it was never going to cross over, but there was a certain kind of attentiveness to craft that really elevated black gospel music in this context to an element of high art.
Let's listen to a little bit of that.
If they can't see, how will they turn? If they can't hear, how will they learn? Touch their eyes, bless their lives. Hear this prayer, hear my cry.
CeCe Winans, the title track from her new album, Let Them Fall in Love. Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown, and there's somebody who has been faithful, you should pardon the pun, to gospel music all the way through, right from the very beginning.
From the beginning. She's made a choice, I think, about someone like Shirley Caesar in that regard, never crossing over.
Yeah.
And
her father was pretty serious about not doing it either, right? I mean, he talked about that. Natalie, we've talked a lot about Rhapsody, and you can't talk enough about her, if you ask me, but her new album, Layla's Wisdom, is up for a Grammy, and it's a chance to shout out. I mean, that's a terrific album, isn't it?
It's absolutely amazing. And I think it's wonderful and incredible and totally apropos that Rhapsody is up for a Grammy or two. And, you know, she deserves it. She's been working hard for a long time, much longer than I'm aware of. And that she is getting this sort of recognition is really special.
Ninth Wonder 2.
Yeah, Ninth Wonder 2, absolutely.
The only woman who's nominated in the Best Album category. And up against giants. I mean,
right.
Literally with Kendrick
right.
and Jay-Z.
And Jay-Z, exactly.
I mean, literally giants, right? And giants who both have such a contribution to her career.
That's right.
Which also, so even if she wins, it shines a light on them.
Yeah.
Mark Anthony Neal is the chair of the Department of African and African American Studies at Duke University. Natalie Bullock Brown is a professor of film and broadcast media at St. Augustine's University in Raleigh. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The State of Things, this edition of Back Channel. It's all on our website, stateofthings.org, a program produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Jennifer Bookland, Robert Kinlaw, Angie Perrin, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.